You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 8th of August 2016 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, over a million people turn out in Istanbul in support of Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. We'll be asking who his supporters are and whether his policies reflect a shared vision with the EU.
They say there is no death penalty in the EU. Sovereignty belongs to the people. So if the people make this decision, I'm sure the political parties will comply.
My guests, Kathleen Burke and Phil Clark, will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including the money game of US politics. We'll ask why both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump need to win over donors as well as the American voters. Plus, we'll also be looking at Australia's flawed relationship with its indigenous communities and looking at some of the strangest sports to grace the Olympics throughout history. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Phil Clark, reader in comparative and international politics at SOAS, University of London, and also Kathleen Burke, professor of modern and contemporary history at UCL. Welcome both to the programme. Now, yesterday, the Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, organised a rally that saw over a million people gather in Istanbul's Yenikapi parade ground. The Democracy and Martyrs rally, which saw Erdogan joined by leaders from two of Turkey's three main opposition parties, was billed as a demonstration in support of democracy. The pro-Kurdish People's Democratic Party, the HDP, was absent. At the rally, Erdogan stated that he would support the return of the death penalty if the Turkish public and the Turkish parliament called for it. The rhetoric looks set to distance Turkey further from its eventual goal of EU membership. Capital punishment is not condoned by any of the EU's member states. Let's just hear a little of what he had to say yesterday. Ankara'da Cumhurbaşkanlığı
Külliyesi önünde. They say there is no death penalty in the EU or the council, or here or there. Well, the US has it, Japan has it, China has it, most of the world has it. So they are allowed to have it. We used to have it until 1984. Sovereignty belongs to the people. So if the people make this decision, I'm sure the political parties will comply.
Well, there we have it. That's President Erdogan yesterday hinting that he'd like to see a return, or more than hinting that he'd like to see a return of the death penalty. Kathleen, the numbers looked extraordinary on the images we saw, and we say a million people. Some of his supporters claimed up to 5 million people turned out. Apart from the fact that he has a lot of popular support, what do those numbers mean, and what does this display of this rhetoric over the weekend mean, do you think?
Well, one thing the numbers must mean is people saying, we do not want military coups. We do not want a military dictatorship. And if the choice is between even authoritarian democracy and the military coup, we are for Erdogan and parliament and the democracy. So in one sense, it was actually support of the Turkish state as much as anything. Secondly, of course, Erdogan's supporters, he's always had huge support in the country. What was interesting was that both opposition party leaders were also at the rally, although the Kurds weren't invited. It's funny that. So it was a display of national unity, both defiant and also to say to anyone who didn't feel unified, you're going to be left out if you're not careful.
Phil, impressive?
I think so. And I think it highlights just some of the failings in the Western media's depiction of Turkey over the last few weeks, that this idea that the whole country must be cowed by Erdogan, there must be widespread fear and consternation through the population. Actually, what this shows is that the country is much more complex than that, that there is a section of the population that undoubtedly is fearful, but there's a section of the population that's extremely and vociferously supportive of the president and the current regime. And I think where that leads to in the months to come is a very divided country. And I think this is going to be really fascinating to watch. What happens as that million-plus crowd that was there on Sunday mobilizes politically behind the president, but undoubtedly will also clash with a big section of the population that's very opposed to particularly the crackdown over the last few weeks. How is that going to come to a head is a really big question.
Kathy?
Well, one problem with that as well is that he's fairly well wiped out most of the opposition media, the journalists and so forth. So those who could immediately bring a focus in opposition have gone the way, at least temporarily, if you can have a temporary dodo, so that there is no one obvious at this point who can mobilize publicly, except, of course, the opposition party leaders. And they're going to have to be very careful because Erdogan is equating any sort of opposition at this point to be a Glenist.
It's sure that, you know, events are conspiring or have conspired to help Erdogan. For just a side issue, these numbers are extraordinary. But, you know, we had, you know, a march in London of a million people who were opposed to war in Iraq. A war happened in Iraq. You know, we saw tens of thousands of people turn out on the streets of Cairo to demonstrate in support of the Brotherhood and against Mubarak and for a form of democracy that didn't happen. So sometimes you can mobilize millions of people around a moment, but it doesn't always mean that in the end you get your way.
I think that that's true up to a point, although this is clearly unusual even in Turkish political history, that the Turkish press has been reporting since Sunday just how unusual this event was in terms of its scale. I think maybe one of the other factors playing into this is that it's also a broad-based crowd. So I think we also would have to recognize some of the important divisions there. And I think Kathy's already put her finger on that there's part of this crowd that is just completely shocked by the idea of a military coup and a military government. But there's another contingent that supports Erdogan primarily because of religious reasons. And these two things don't necessarily mesh. I mean, there are a lot of secularists also that were completely shocked by the coup. So I think that's why it's going to be important not just to remark on what happened yesterday, but also to see where this goes in the next few weeks. And whether that 1 million, for example, can be mobilized in any kind of coherent fashion, or whether, in fact, the divisions within that 1 million people become more apparent in the days and weeks to come.
And Kathy, it's interesting. You know, you can get out, you know, potentially millions and millions of people. But as we heard there, you know, he's suggesting that we have a return to the death penalty. Once you move away from the populist moment of this is terrible, we don't want this, and then start sitting around a table deciding what you do to make sure it doesn't happen again, and putting in place policies that may restrict people's freedoms, etc. That's a harder thing, isn't it, then, for him to bring everybody along on that kind of journey?
Well, yes. Forgive me. I mean, you can do an awful lot of thing in a major rally. You can do an awful lot of thing in headlines that then becomes difficult. The usual cliche is true. The devil is in the detail. And whether he can carry along everyone, the thing is, he is going to be able to carry along everyone for a while. The situation, he's got it right now. No opposition is going to dare, particularly, to stand up against, because he can say, look, the people are with me, and so forth and so on, and the sovereignty and the people. Okay, but I think in about 6 months' time, we may find things becoming extremely difficult. And if I could just say one thing, that what we have to look at is not so much, well, yes, what's happening in Turkey, but I think we have to look what Erdogan is doing outside. After all, what's important, he's seeing Putin today.
Yeah.
And he's being very anti-NATO. Are we watching this as part of an entire revolution in where Turkey, what Turkey has meant over the since for the past 30 or 40 years, and the position it has had as an island of stability in the Eastern Mediterranean? Are we going to lose that? And that would be dangerous.
Well, we're going to move on now because we wanted to talk about Hillary Clinton. She has a famously cozy relationship with Wall Street, and the Democratic Party is not short of a dime or two. But her rival Donald Trump had a very successful July, raising some $80 million from donors supportive of his cause. He's been so successful that Clinton camp have become concerned about their own financial clout. The Clintons, both Hillary and Bill, and Hillary's running mate, Tim Kaine, will appear at over 80 finance events in more than 25 states throughout August. So just how vital
vital is it to win over the money men and women before winning a US election? Well, Cathy, I think you may have a view on this. How vital is it?
Well, it's not unique to the United States that money fuels politics. After all, Britain in the 19th century was fueled by money and local politics. So this is not surprising. At least it's reasonably transparent, she says, in a way of trying to give some gloss to the thing. Trump got 80 million last month. Clinton got 90 million. But Clinton, A, is behind where Obama was at this time, and B, Trump has just come from nothing and gained 80 million, rather like Bernie Sanders. The point is that the Clinton camp didn't really think he could do it because he hadn't been doing it, and because the really big Republican donors, like the Koch brothers, we're having nothing to do with him. So now the Clinton group has realized that they can't just coast. They can't just coast in terms of polls, but they can't just coast in terms of money, because one often feeds the other. And the difficulty as well is they have to get the adverts out on television in August to get the idea of what they say Trump is and what Clinton is solidified in August, because once you get 6 weeks within the election, in the first week of November, it's almost too late.
But Cathy, from what I understand, is the success of Trump has been getting people who are paying $10, $20, $100 to cough up their money in a way that Hillary just hasn't been able to do. Maybe Bernie Sanders was able to do that. Is she missing some of the tricks of social media, some of the tricks of connecting with the grassroots? Because, even when we hit 25 events, going around to see some of the biggest donors, that's incredible and amazing and will probably be successful. But it doesn't have the kind of energy of connecting with thousands and thousands of slightly angry voters who just feel, my $10, my $100 could make a difference to Mr. Trump.
Well, that's for insurgents. That's why Bernie Sanders got it. That's why Obama got it. That's why Trump gets it. They have sold. They were able to sell themselves as being not part of the establishment. The establishment, by definition, doesn't need my $10. I should have thought is one argument. Whereas those who aren't part of the establishment do. For heaven's sakes, Trump was part of the establishment. The idea that this cowboy coming out on a white horse, coming out of God knows where, to confront the establishment is one of the great cartoons of this week, I think. So I think what we do have to remember is that the United States is rather large, even not counting on Hawaii and Alaska. It's London to Damascus, from the east to the west coast. You cannot do retail politics. You cannot go out and shake hands everywhere. You have to have television and radio to reach the electorate. And I think when people cast aspersions, in a sense, and say how appalling American politics are because you need the money, you do need the money, in many respects, to reach the voters.
Phil, does it concern you when you see these numbers? Cathy's given a very good, actually, an interesting defense there of the system, in a way. But it does mean that power is going to rest with vested interest. It's very hard. We've seen today somebody who said they're going to run as a kind of alternative Republican candidate. But you know that's kind of hopeless without the cash.
Yeah, I would see it as a deeply worrying trend. I think you, on the one hand, you've got Trump, who comes completely out of the corporate world. You've got Clinton, who comes out of this really complicated set of relationships with corporate actors, high-paying speeches in front of J.P. Morgan's headquarters and all the rest of it. And this, I think, shows just how difficult it is to disentangle politics from donors' interests. I mean, those who, pay the piper call the tune. People don't give money for no reason. And these very big donors, I think, expect very direct policy outcomes in return. And on top of that, this comes in an era where politics is fighting so heavily against the problems of corporate greed and financial collapse. I mean, if ever this was a time for politics to try and disentangle itself from big corporate interests, it would have to be now. But in fact, we're seeing a consistency of chasing the dollar on the part of political players, which has dominated U.S. politics now for 20 or 30 years.
It's even worse now, of course, after the Supreme Court decision several years ago, which said that a corporation was really a person, and it would be an abridgment of this corporation's right of free speech to try to limit the amount of money it could get. Now, if that particular Supreme Court decision could be reversed somehow, a lot of the money would then, if not dry up, it would certainly slow down from the massive Niagara it is now.
Kathy, do you feel that the results in U.S. elections, whether you know a state level or in a presidential vote, do you think they are a reflection of the money spent?
I think enough so to make it seem worth its while to do it, yes. I mean, the idea of you know the little man or the little woman coming out of nowhere and gaining you know traction and becoming the winner, I think is more a fairy tale because people aren't going to know who you are. I mean, England is one third the size of California, for heaven's sakes. Without this media exposure, people just aren't even going to know the candidates.
Phil.
I mean, particularly in an environment with such a low voter turnout, that this is an election that will be won or lost by the parties that can or cannot get voters off
Absolutely.
Their butts to go and put a ballot in a box. And,
Absolutely.
And I think that's one of the sort of structural features of U.S. politics that skews this issue of raising finance, of the way that the parties campaign. And it also, I think, dictates the kind of sensationalism that we've seen over the last year or so. You have to capture people's imaginations. You have to make them angry in particular to get them out of their houses on voting day, which leads to this kind of chase for the dollar, but also completely shapes the kind of political messages that parties are putting together. And of course, I contrast that with a country like my own, Australia, where I come from, with compulsory voting, which has its own vagaries and its own problems. But one issue that we don't have is this one of having to really mobilize, often in a really crass way, people simply to go and vote.
Kathy, today we are going to hear from Mr. Trump. He's about to make a big economic speech about the things he believes, because it's clear that he's going to say that how he feels taxation should be used. He's going to say it seems that childcare should be able to be set against tax. He's going to say how he would kind of run the economy. Is that enough, do you think, to turn around the extraordinary terrible kind of journey his campaign took last week?
Well, he's going to say things that people like. He's going to say instead of having corporation taxes at 35%, he's going to have them at 15%. He's going to say that everyone can get free childcare and so forth. And he's going to cut taxes massively. And the fact that means the United States will have $10 trillion worth of debt within 10 years, of course, is neither here nor there. What some pundit ought to do is compare and contrast Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump's economic programs. I suspect there'll be some overlap there in ways that don't necessarily appear when they're separate.
Well, it certainly seems that some of his views are to the left of Hillary, Phil. His heart is, this is, we were talking about Erdogan a moment ago, this is when you come into the realm of the populist politician. It's quite hard to pin these people down in some senses because they're not speaking from the traditional kind of rule books of left or right.
That's right. And we've seen it with Brexit and other political processes in the last few months, that this post-truth and post-fact type of politics where leaders can make grand claims, they're not necessarily held accountable to those claims, and it may not really matter by the time the voters turn out in November. I mean, I'm also fascinated by this discourse around Trump, that he's probably the better financial manager than Hillary because of his business background. It's a fascinating mythology, and we've seen this in various forms in the US and the UK and Australia and elsewhere over the last 20 years or so, that because you come out of a business background, regardless of what your record may have been as a business person, and Trump's record is extremely patchy, that somehow this automatically means that you're the safest financial pair of hands should you become president. But Trump, I think, will also manipulate that kind of mythology over the next few weeks.
Well, we're going to leave it there for one second because we're going to have a short break. But when we come back, we're going to be talking about Australia. And my guests, of course, today are Kathleen Burke and Phil Clark.
Monocle's summer travel-themed sister publication, The Escapist, is back for a second outing. Printed in the same compact form as our winter forecast, it takes you to 10 lesser-known cities around the world with sunny stories to tell. And here's the Monocle team to guide you on your way.
I headed to St. John's, the most easterly point in North America, to see how the Canadian city that doesn't quite feel Canadian is coping with the end of the oil boom.
To bring a bit of sunshine to proceedings, I hopped on a flight to Sicily to visit the island's capital of Palermo. But although it is often preceded by its shadowy reputation as the erstwhile home of the mafia, the Sicilian capital is today stepping into the light. A dynamic mayor with an ambitious plan and a new generation of young entrepreneurs are helping Palermo to fulfill its majestic potential.
The Escapist is on newsstands now. Get yours today or become a subscriber at monocle.com and never miss out.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, and still with me are Kathleen Burke and Phil Clark. A cartoon published by the Australian newspaper last week by the cartoonist Bill Leake has drawn condemnation from Indigenous communities across Australia for depicting a drunk Aboriginal father who fails to recognise his own son. The cartoon has been criticised for presenting a stereotyped and racist view of the challenges faced by Indigenous communities. As a response, Indigenous Australians have launched a campaign of posting photos of themselves with their fathers on social media to demonstrate the positive role played by Indigenous dads. A little earlier on The Globalist, on Monocle 24, we spoke to the former deputy editor of The Australian, Peter Wilson, and we asked him whether he would have published Leake's cartoon during his time at the paper.
Yes, I would, actually. Of course, Bill Leake, the cartoonist, is one of Australia's most senior and honoured cartoonists, you know, has the right to express his view. This is a hard-hitting, very confronting and not particularly tasteful cartoon, but he certainly has the right to express that opinion, and it does raise some important points. I mean, people have gone ballistic saying that it is racist, it stereotypes all Aboriginals by presenting them as drunk parents, when I think that is pretty unfair. I mean, if a cartoon had depicted, say, a woman shoplifting saying, well, it wasn't my fault, the store didn't have any security guards, it's their fault, would that cartoon be saying all women are shoplifters? You know, I don't think so. And clearly this cartoon is saying that there are some irresponsible Indigenous fathers in Australia, and that is an issue that needs to be dealt with. He's not saying, I can't see how you can say that he's saying every Indigenous father is irresponsible.
Well, that was the former deputy editor of The Australian, Peter Wilson there. Phil, just before you, I can see you're ready to dive in. I think we're all ready to dive in. Could you just give us like one line on Bill Leake? Is he celebrated? Is he famous? Has he been around for years? Who is Bill Leake?
Yeah, Bill Leake is probably one of the best known Australian political cartoonists. He's been at The Australian for more than 20 years. And it should be said he has form on this kind of thing. This isn't the first time there's been a furor over his depiction of either the Australian Indigenous population or Muslims. Those have been the two groups that he's been accused of targeting in the last 10 or 15 years. So this doesn't come out of the blue. In fact, their entire website set up to critique the work of Bill Leake. So yeah, this is only the latest in a long string of this kind of thing.
Peter Wilson's view there that, you know, just because you're showing one Aboriginal dad not recognising his son, but then comparing it to the idea of like a cartoon of a shoplifter being compared to all white women. Yeah, you don't have to be very far away from the far right to find that quite a complicated argument. It doesn't really stick, does it?
No, that argument holds no water whatsoever. I mean, the cartoon depicts a very generic looking Indigenous man. So the purpose of the cartoon quite clearly was to talk about Aboriginal Australians in general. There was absolutely no specific feature of the person who was being depicted. So I think Peter Wilson's argument is fatuous in that regard. But also I think we have to put this cartoon in context. I mean, the cartoon was also a response to a story that had broken the week before about torture and mistreatment of particularly young Indigenous males in the prison system in the Northern Territory, which is a really endemic situation in many parts of Australia. So Bill Leake's response to that terrible situation is in essence to say it's the fault of the Indigenous population themselves. The reason that so many young black men are incarcerated in Australia, the reason that they are then subjected to this terrible treatment in inside those prisons is because of their drunkenness, because of their unruly behavior, and because of the lack of effective parenting. So it's very clear that Bill Leake's intention wasn't just to speak about one or two particular Indigenous individuals. It was to make a very big statement about the Indigenous population as a whole.
And just before I bring in Kathy, just a tiny touch of Australian history. To outsiders, it seems strange because we know that many of the early settlers brought alcohol and used that against Aboriginal people who had very little ability to kind of process it. Physically, it was a harsh thing. And there is a problem of alcohol abuse now in many communities who are living in poverty and alcohol is present. So it's got a horrible history, alcohol, with the Indigenous community as well.
No, that's absolutely true. And the one part of Peter Wilson's comment there that I would agree with is that this cartoon has brought to the fore a whole range of very important issues that we need to talk about. I think alcoholism and its origins in Indigenous communities is one of those issues. But I think the other issue that has come out of this cartoon is the extraordinary complacency and the easy racism that we see in much of the Australian population and in much of the Australian press. I mean, I think anybody who saw that cartoon in The Australian last week would be shocked that a national newspaper in any supposedly liberal society could actually publish that. And I would go as far as to say it would be unbelievable for a cartoon like that to be published in the US or the UK. So as an Australian living overseas, it begs the question for me, how is that even possible in Australia for a cartoon like that to be published in such a prominent place? And I think it alerts us to some fairly ugly undercurrents in the society as a whole, but particularly in the Murdoch press, which again has a very long history of these kinds of depictions of the Indigenous population.
Kathy, you only have to go back, in history sense, you don't go that far back. I'm sure you can still find now, but you go back to the 70s or the 60s, and Native American, the indigenous people of America were shown in cowboy and Indian movies in a very kind of one-dimensional way. They were the baddies. They were had tomahawks. They killed nice white women. But that depiction has changed. Would it be shocking to see such a cartoon about a Native American these days?
I agree with Phil. It is inconceivable, except perhaps on the KKK website or something of that sort. It would not be the done thing.
Well, we're going to move to a nicer topic now, because the Olympics is in full swing in Rio. And all this week on our earlier show, The Globalist, at 7 a.m. London time, you can hear a series of interviews focusing on some of the strangest sports, both past and present, at the Games. These range from pistol dueling to ski ballet. So to end Midori House today, I'd like to ask our guests, if you were going to enter your own unusual Olympic sport, what would it be? Kathleen, would you like to go first?
Okay, well, I tried to think of something that would celebrate other qualities than just strength and being able to leap high and to swim fast and bulk and so forth. I wanted something that would show balance and poise, and so I suggest egg and spoon race.
I like the egg and spoon. I mean, you could do a kind of regional varieties depending on the size of birds in your country as well. So maybe ostrich eggs for like people living in the sub-Saharan Africa, for example. Phil, Aussie?
I like Kathy's idea there. I think the variation I would like to see is so many political leaders hide behind their athletes and sort of put them forward as the embodiment of their nation. I'd like to see the head of states themselves compete. I think there should be a sort of 100-meter sprint for heads of state. I want to see the Queen. I want to see Obama. I want to see Trudeau. I want to see various African presidents.
What about Merkel versus Theresa May versus Hillary Clinton?
I would pay to see that. I would be fixated on an event like that.
I might take a few bets on a few kind of wrestling matches in our own offices as well. I'm not sure why I don't. Three-legged race, the old school favourite. That'd be quite nice, because then you could team people up from other nations, get them kind of working together in harmony. North and South Korea maybe on the same team and things. Well, we'll see. But anyway, too many drugs there apparently still. But we'll have to find out what happens later on in the Rio Olympics. But for now, that's all we have on today's episode of Midori House. And my guests today have been Phil Clark and also Kathleen Burke. This show, well, it's going to be back at the same time tomorrow. It was produced, though, today by Tom Hall, and it was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and also by Molly Ingleby. And our studio manager was Kieran Matthew Banerjee. There's more music right next, and then at 1900 hours, it's The Culture Show. which today is, of course, with Robert Bound. And we'll have more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily, which is at 2200 hours. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours London time. But from me, Andrew Tuck, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.